my city. Flickering dirty neon over alleys mean and dirty streets, while my neighborhood is torn down around me.
Well, everybody, from a nightclub with lots of sound effects at the end of the universe, this is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, coming to you again miraculously on the 27th of October, almost Halloween, 2013. Big show tonight. We're probably going to roll. We may roll without a break. I don't know. Let's see. We got a lot to do tonight. Got a great guest. Dmitry Orlov is back. But first, let me start with a couple things. I want to say goodbye to a great musician, Lou Reed, passed away yesterday. God, I'm going to miss that guy. He and Warren Zevon were just in a class by themselves. And we thank you for your music, Lou. Rest in peace and have a good journey and have a great jam session when you get to wherever you're going. Just before airtime tonight, another new earthquake was reported off the east coast of Japan. 5.5 showed up on RT first. This is just within the last hour or so. An aftershock to the aftershock, and Arnie Gunderson and all of us wonder how many more typhoons and aftershocks the place can take. That's one sword hanging over our head tonight, among many. But I want to start with a thought before we get to Dmitry. When I was a brand new policeman, just graduated from the police academy, I hit the streets in the south end of Wilshire Division in south central Los Angeles it was probably February of 1974. And all of my training officers, almost all of them, were Vietnam combat vets. And as a matter of fact, it's going to be 40 years ago in November of 1973 that I was sworn in as a police officer. I don't believe I'm that old, but yes, I do believe I'm that old, and I remember almost all of it. But I remember one of the things that the Vietnam vets talked about. And I soaked up everything they had to say because these guys, 9th Infantry, 1st Air Cav, 173rd Airborne Brigade, 101st Airborne, 5th Marines, these guys had been there, and they had amazing tales of survival and things that you soaked up because you knew that the words that they offered could save your life and you pay attention. And one of the things they talked about was a substance called white phosphorus, Willie Peter, as they called it on the radio. White phosphorus is a weapon of war that is absolutely horrible. The U.S. used it all over Vietnam. The Vietnamese, the NVA, used it back when they captured ours and sent it back to us. And if you watch a white phosphorus round explode, it looks a little bit like white fireworks, kind of pretty. But if you get white phosphorus on you, on your skin, your uniform, it will burn and it will not stop. Water doesn't put it out. It will burn through flesh, and it will burn through bone. It will keep going until it burns all the way through. And they described it as a pain that was so severe that you would use your K-bar, you would use your jump knife, you would use your bayonet for your M16, and you would eagerly and willingly dig away your own flesh just to dig it and get it out of you so that it would stop burning. That was the only way to deal with it. And three nights ago, as a Typhoon Francisco, which thank God was gentle and merciful with the east coast of Japan, was looming, I had a dream. And in that dream, I felt and I was communicating with Mother Earth. And she was trying to show me that the three melted cores from Fukushima were like white phosphorus digging into her flesh. And in that, she explained to me that the four typhoons which had hit, there was one before Manyi, there was then Manyi, then Weipa, Weipa dumping 33 inches of rain on Fukushima in one 24-hour period, was Mother Earth's way of trying to extinguish the fires which were causing her great pain. Just a dream, but I felt it, and I believe it. And of course, we know that Fukushima is deteriorating at a breakneck pace. We are all beginning to glean the fact that we are all being irradiated. The symptoms and the signs of radiation poisoning are turning up all over North America, all over the United States. Three cases of cancer at Malibu High School, hair falling out in teachers, et cetera, et cetera. Rise in infant mortality, rise in birth defects, rise in Down syndrome. People have got Geiger counters now, and I'm getting elevated readings all over the place. All those symptoms are there. And I have a brief message for all the people who are hoping some great new techno fix will solve all of these problems. Listen, you dumb son of a bitches, get this. The automobile was a techno fix because every major city in the United States, when we had a population of 90 to 100 million people at the turn of the last century, the automobile was the techno fix for the fact that cities were awash in horse shit. Tar sands are a techno fix for peak oil. Shale gas, fracking is a techno fix for the fact that the North American continent went off the natural gas cliff for conventional gas in 2002, 2003. Nuclear power is a techno fix for the fact that there wasn't enough electricity. So get the fact that techno fixes, and all of you who are hoping that geoengineering and HARP are going to fix anything, or chemtrails, are absolute deluded psychopathic people who are dangerous to all human life. As Albert Einstein said, you cannot fix a situation by using the same consciousness that created it. Humankind's techno fixes are what is killing us right now. Before we move on to Dimitri, people are really beginning to ask questions about radiation. They're beginning to understand because you don't drop dead in 5 minutes, that's the legal maneuver being used to get away from the fact that we are all being murdered. And there is one particular movie that I have watched three or four times in my life. That is the best movie I have ever seen about human courage dealing in the face of radiation poisoning. It's a movie starring Harrison Ford and Liam Neeson called K-19 Widowmaker, which is about a Russian submarine in the early 1960s that had an amazingly dangerous, deadly reactor malfunction. If you want to know what heroes and warriors are like, unlike the exploited underclass that the Yakuza in Japan are slamming into work at Fukushima and poisoning them and misleading them and skimming off their pay, if you want to talk about courage and what kind of heroism it takes to deal with radiation, get that movie. It's a fabulous movie. K-19 Widowmaker, Harrison Ford, and Liam Neeson. All right. Now, I did a little writing earlier in the day. I'm going to read this, and then I'm going to bring Dimitri on. I'm just so pissed off, as so many of us are, as we gradually, not you and me, not me and Dimitri, but as so many people become aware that our lives are in danger right now, this minute. And I wrote, this was a thought for the day, fight back by attacking the system that creates all of this. Bite the hardest bullet, not the easy ones, because the easy bullets don't change anything. And if your death looks certain anyway, find the courage to fight the good fight that was the only real fight that ever mattered. Fight the fight you should have been fighting all along. Buying potassium iodide tablets only reinforces your fear victim position, making you feel more helpless, confirming it. By now, the more mature spiritual souls have realized that you can't stock up on enough specific items that you might need, and you couldn't carry them all once, or if you had them, to a new place that might or might not have a stable climate, fresh water, arable land, and less radiation for a few weeks, for a few months, or a few years. A place that you haven't found or secured permission to occupy yet. People seem obsessed with finding places they can run to, whether it's in the form of potassium iodide tablets, Geiger counters, permaculture. Nothing against permaculture, but practicing is not going to solve what's killing you. Or recycling, or South America, or pornography, or drugs, or criticism of others, or even comedy. It's only when people realize that they're going to die anyway, when they realize that these flights, these pitiful fixes are but delusions. It's only then, when they choose to stand and fight the real enemy, that anything at all useful or real becomes possible. How many times in movies or songs or TV shows have we watched a kid or people being bullied, tearing off little bits of their soul, tossing them to the insatiable beast? Here, take that. Here, take that. Maybe that'll stop you. Only to realize that the beast of fear is never satisfied, and it will not be until it has consumed everything. Only when one soul or one people can say, that's it, and they stand up, Only then does the audience finally cheer. Well, we are both audience and we are narcissistic movie stars facing our death scene in the movie of our lives right now, today. Don't send me any freaking comedian. Send me Crazy Horse. Send me Sitting Bull. Send me U.S. Grant. Send me William Wallace. Send me Joan of Arc. Send me Thomas Paine and Patrick Henry. Send me Harriet Tubman. Send me John Brown. Send me Spartacus, and I will cheer. It takes love, the greatest love, the most powerful love, to stand and be ready to die and unwilling to run anymore. I will not tear off another piece of my soul and throw it away because I'm afraid. I stopped doing that 35 years ago, and I've been a free man ever since. So now we're going to get to Dmitry Orlov, and I'm hoping we're the Russian-American tag team here tonight. You all know and love Dmitry like we all do. There's some names you just say, and everybody knows who they are. He's the author of Reinventing Collapse, Hold Your Applause, Absolutely Positive, a collection of essays, and his latest book, The Five Stages of Collapse. But recently, at cluborlov.blogspot.com, Dmitry published a bombshell, The Sixth Stage of Collapse. And here's a quote. He writes, "And so it seems that there may not be a happy end to my story of the five stages of collapse, the first three of which, financial, commercial, political, are inevitable, while the last two, social and cultural, are entirely optional, but have, alas, already run their course in many parts of the world. Because, you see, there is also the sixth stage, which I have previously neglected to mention, environmental collapse, at the end of which we are left without a home, having rendered Earth, our home planet, uninhabitable. The tragic outcome may not be avoidable, and if it is not unavoidable, then that's about the only problem left that's worth solving. The solution can be almost arbitrarily expensive in both life and treasure. I would humbly suggest that it's worth all the money in the world plus a few billion lives, because if a solution isn't found, then that treasure and those lives are forfeit anyway." Beautiful. "A solution for avoiding the sixth stage must be found, but I don't know what that solution would look like. I do find it unsafe to blithely assume that collapse will simply take care of the problem for us. Some people may find the subject matter so depressing that it makes them want to lie down in a comfortable position on something warm and soft and die. But there may be others who still have some fight left in them and who do wish to leave a survivable planet to their children and grandchildren. Let's not expect them to use conventional orthodox methods to work and play well with others, to order to be polite and reasonable in dealing with the rest of us. Let's just hope that they have a plan and that they get on with it." Dmitry Orlov, my old friend, Povadich, we have walked about a decade together. Welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour.
Great to be on your show, Mike.
Powerful words, Dmitry. What brought about this change? I hear you watched Guy McPherson last week.
Well, I was with him at a conference a while ago, and I was impressed by what he had to say. And the other thing is that I've been watching the events unfold at Fukushima, and before that, I was sort of a Chernobyl nerd, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I've read a ridiculous amount of relatively technical information about that particular catastrophe as well. So I know quite a bit about, the state of the nuclear industry and the fact that there's not enough money in the world to actually dismantle all of the existing installations. And at the same time, we have at CERN in Switzerland an elite group of nuclear scientists meeting this week to discuss building the next generation of nuclear reactors, which will be thorium-based because we're running out of uranium and plutonium-fueled reactors seem to be a dead end. And little that I know about thorium, the early part of the fuel cycle, before you actually get a reactor up and running, is probably enough to kill us all already. And so we have a small number of people on this planet who know enough about nuclear energy to actually handle these situations.
Mm-hmm.
And they're busy making it worse. And that seems like a problem to me.
Techno fixes, yes. And Guy has been like walking point for a lot of us now on climate collapse, 25 now positive feedback loops now identified. But he's been talking in his recent presentation in Boulder that the what's the word? You run out of adjectives after a while. That a cataclysmic methane release of methane hydrates, clathrates, in the Arctic may be enough to wipe out all life on the planet within a matter of months if that's triggered now. So now we're nearing a point where it's kind of pretty apparent, because people are very much aware that many nuclear facilities are failing, and Fukushima's deteriorating rapidly, that our backs are to the wall, literally, and the awareness of that may be here. Did that encourage you to write what you wrote in the sixth stage?
Well, no, it's just the really basic, simple realization that if collapse is to be survivable, it has to be engineered. You can't just, like, give up and say, oh, yeah, it'll all take care of itself. No, it won't. Yeah, worst-case scenario is we're extinct, and we can do better than that. That's what it feels like. Even if a fuel pool at Fukushima, you know, caves in and goes critical and all of that stuff is emitted into the stratosphere in one giant plume that circles the northern hemisphere, there's probably still something that people ought to be thinking about, mm-hmm. like moving to the southern hemisphere, maybe. I mean, there's always something you can do, right?
Although I'm not sure that everyone in the southern hemisphere, which has much less land than the northern hemisphere, would be sitting there with open arms waiting for the gringos and the Europeans to arrive. And be willing to share their land with them.
I think we'd be hanging out on cement barges, you know, anchored off of some shoal somewhere in mid-ocean.
Oh, my God.
Right. There isn't enough land.
That sounds like a bad Kevin Costner movie. Sorry.
It is, yes.
Did you see the movie K-19, by the way?
No, I haven't.
Oh, I think you should. It was very, very Russian, very brave, and a lot of good truth about radiation in there that's I think very illuminating. So,
oh, I have seen it. The Widowmaker, the one where the nuclear reactor blew up on a nuclear site.
Yes, I've seen it. Great movie. So, that being said, looking back on your very respectable large body of work over the last decade or so, how would you summarize that you're viewing things differently now, and what would you offer to those who have followed you, like so many of us who have walked this walk for a long time? We all have our followings. What would you say to them now that's different?
Well, basically, the realization from my last book is that I should definitely stop writing about collapse. Because it's a losing proposition. And you know, I think that, you know, this last post that I came up with last week is the, you know, the other bookend. I think the article, the first article that you published, the first one that I ever wrote way back when, was one bookend, and this is the other one. So, you know, I'm moving on. There are other things to do. And, you know, that's the real serious takeaway. And the other thing is that if you're just going to go all out and depress people, that's not totally helpful. And it turns out that it's very difficult to prod people into any kind of useful action by giving them stories of failure, to put it simply.
Okay,
and as a motivational speaker, I think I have failed, so I have to reassess my potential and adjust my strategy accordingly.
Well, as a motivational speaker, my brother Tovarich, we have all failed, and I probably started that walk a longer time ago, trying to motivate people to change something. What we have been waiting for is the brick wall against which people's consciousness would be back to the point where they might act or think differently. Right? What do you think?
Well, it's every person's brick wall. It's very individualistic, you know. And by the time each person encounters that brick wall, it's too late. So you can't really motivate groups of people by saying, here's the brick wall in front of you, because they'll just stop paying attention. And that's what I discovered over and over again. I have a loyal following of, I don't know, maybe a few thousand people. And that's it. You know, that's all I'll ever reach. And the thing about these people is I feel a little bit sorry about having them as my following, because I think that they're dwelling on this a little too much. I think I'm depressing, you know.
Well,
I'm wondering about the psychological effect and the principle of first do no harm. I mean, I have to be producing some tangible benefit if I'm depressing people in the process, and
well,
I'm yet to see that benefit.
You know, it would seem to me, and this is the code by which I have always walked, that telling the truth, I love people enough to tell and to have told them the truth, even if it does depress them. You know, coming from my training as a police officer and being in life and death situations and shootings, it's far less important to me if I hurt somebody's feelings if I save their life. Or, you know, if as a result of that, and I think Guy McPherson would agree with this, Carolyn Baker, Rich Heinberg, all of us would say that, well, yeah, we may have depressed some people, but if we have awakened them to a change in consciousness that prompts them to take action, that's a different thing. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I agree that it's worth it if the results are apparent and measurable. But I haven't really seen that. I don't see the trend. All I see is the same people who sort of got addicted to the message, and they're just following it along. And somehow along the way, I got roped myself into pursuing this sort of theme of collapse. And I think I've said everything I can on the subject of mm-hmm. collapse. I've researched it fully. I've gone through stacks of books. I've summarized my findings every which way. And, you know, that's it. I collapse as a subject. I think I've exhausted it. I seriously feel that way.
This feels like a real good time for a song, Dimitri. You picked a song tonight, and we'll go back after the song saying, okay, once you've exhausted collapse, what's left, which is probably your humanity. And I love the song you picked tonight. It's by a group called Gogol Bordello, and what's
Very
it called?
Good.
Through the Roof and Underground, right? Tell me about why you like this song so much before we play it.
It's a song about escape, which is something that we are all looking for.
How beautiful. Welcome to a nightclub at the end of the world. Here's Dmitri Orlov's song for the night, Through the Roof and Underground. Let's go. This is a fun song.
Trap set up for you in every corner of this town, and so you learn the only way to go is underground. When there's a trap set up for you in every corner of your room, and so you learn the only way to go is through the roof. Ooh, through the roof, underground. Ooh, through the roof, underground. We're crossing border after border, we realize the difference is none. It's underdog zoo, and if you want it, you always have to make your own fun. And I see upper dog leisurely sighing, the local cultures are dying and dying. The programmed robots are buying and buying, and oh, secluded freaks, they are still trying, trying. Boy Scouts learn to read between the lines. The silver rabbits hop between their father's lies. And Boy Scouts ask, Blah, where do they go? They go to the country that they only know. Just like the meanings, they lay between the lines. Between the borders, the real countries hide. Their strategy was so they advertise. Their strategy of being is one of in-your-face disguise. Oh, 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 through the road, underground. Will be discombobled around the stump of bigotry alone. Серебряные зайцы водят хоровод.
I was sitting here slapping my knees, tapping my foot with a big grin on my face. God, thank you, Dimitri, for picking that song. How did you come across this band?
Oh, I know of Eugene Hoots, even though I don't think I've ever talked with him. I think he's great. It's a great song. You can just feel the vodka kicking in as the song progresses.
You most certainly can. This is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, here on the Lifeboat Hour on Progressive Radio Network. At the bottom of the hour, we are going to roll without a commercial break tonight. I'm hanging out with my old friend, Dimitri Orlov, who I met 10 years ago, I think it was. Was it 2002 or 2003 that Dale Allen Pfeiffer hooked us up, Dimitri?
I think it was 2004.
Okay. All right. Almost a decade. But, boy, you know, we in terms of watching the evolution of the world since we both started talking about, since we were talking about peak oil now for a decade, Dimitri's piece that he did for From the Wilderness was just breathtaking in its comparison of the rapid collapse of the Soviet Union. Comparing it with reinventing collapse and all of that was just a marvelous insight. Looking back now, it's probably a decade since you originally wrote that. What does your hindsight tell you in your comparisons about the fall of the Soviet Union and the fall of the U.S.? And let me start with one question. Is it possible, tongue in my cheek, that the U.S. could collapse just as fast, if not faster, than the Soviet Union?
Well, I think that on the one hand, I think I've been vindicated, largely vindicated in my analysis, because since then, the whole idea of the demise of the American empire and the fading of American influence has gone mainstream. And every day we're seeing more and more cracks in that particular facade.
Mm-hmm.
And it's coming from all sorts of directions, and now all sorts of serious politicos and academics are saying the same thing. And so when I first came out with it, it was an outlandish theory, and now everybody's looking at it and saying, yeah, well, yeah, it's happening. So on that level, I think it's worked out. But the other thing that I haven't really paid attention to is that the United States is still something that the rest of the world can't very easily compensate for its failures.
Mm.
So when the U.S. implodes, nobody really has a plan for how to compensate for
yes.
the collapse of the U.S. dollar or, you know, the incredible disruption in finance and commerce that will rip through the world. You know, the collapse of the Soviet Union was really great. When it falls for the United States, it extended its existence by about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the collapse of the United States is not going to extend anyone's existence.
No.
I don't think. So it's kind of a different scenario in that on that level. And so there aren't any lessons to draw. That's the scary thing. It's like, oh yeah, well, you can look at personal adaptation and survival strategies, et cetera. Yeah, you know, be my guest, make use of that information to the best of your ability. But the big picture is that, you know, Russia recovered. The United States is going away. That's the difference.
That's because the energy
is
gone.
A lot of things.
The energy is gone, the resources are gone, and the climate is disappearing rapidly, too.
Well, yeah, all of the underpinnings. Russia is still one of the wealthiest countries in the world, if not the wealthiest, if you just look at natural resources.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States is, you know, drilled like Swiss cheese and has a lot of different types of problems.
Excuse me. A couple of things have cropped up recently as sub-themes that are Russian, and since you are Russian, I would like to get your opinion on them. One of which I have noticed a very intense persecutive dislike on the part of Vladimir Putin and the Russian government for Greenpeace, with a number of Greenpeace activists being thrown in jail. And the other is, and maybe these are just press stories, homophobia being used for some purpose within Russian culture. What's your take on both of those things?
Well, yeah, Russia is nasty in some ways. You know, it's a big, unruly place, and it has to be ruled very strictly in order to exist. And there's always the tendency to overdo it on the part of overzealous Russian officials. Especially if they can completely get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
If they can smell the fact that nobody in Russia will give a damn about it and that there will be this rabid Western media overreaction to it,
mm-hmm.
that will play really well on domestic television,
mm-hmm.
Because they've provoked it, they can take credit for pissing off Westerners. So they'll do it even worse next time.
Uh-huh.
And that has been the dynamic for a while now. So it's like Greenpeace, that's a bunch of Western liberals giving their money to these people who mess with people's livelihoods in our country. They have no business being here.
Mm-hmm.
And we piss them off. You see, now we get brownie points. Okay? Or we imprison some lesbians. We hate lesbians. They love lesbians. We hate them for the fact that they love lesbians. Win-win, you know? So there are a lot of these things that are sort of working their way through Russian politics in a very nasty way that I don't like, and that people here don't realize that they're actually contributing to the cycle. You know, they can't, people in the U.S., they can't abide by the fact that Russians aren't homophobes. They just don't like homosexuality as a culture.
Uh-huh.
There are other cultures that don't like homosexuality either, that the Americans won't even touch, like Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
What did they do to homosexuals? But they can pick on the Russians. And the Russians know that they're being picked on unfairly. And so they pick a fight.
Okay. I was wondering about Greenpeace's presence in the Arctic, which is a mess. Shell's like 2 years behind drilling. That's good. And and all of that. And I was wondering, because I am really sensing, and I have noticed this. I mean, it's not just the paradigm itself. We have David Cameron announcing gung-ho, we're going to build new nuclear stations in Britain. And we have Abbott in Australia tearing up the Great Barrier Reef, and we have Harper in Canada wanting to massacre indigenous peoples and throw out any shred of the law in pursuit of cheap energy, which is, or any kind of energy at this point, no matter how destructive. From your walk on this path, this is my perception. I don't know if you agree or not, but I see the powers that be not giving a damn at all anymore, going balls to the wall, pedal to the metal. We don't care what environment we destroy, what body of water we pollute, how much fresh water we use. Let's get the energy. It's almost like drunken guys trying to make sure there's nothing left when they're done. What do you think?
I don't know that these people think in those terms. I think that they've been sold a story. You know, they've been sold, an investment portfolio, if you will, and they've been told that the only way to make it work is to let the businessmen do their thing. I don't think that they're deep thinkers on the ecological level. I think they respond to signals, and the signals are people say, well, you know, we care about the environment, but we also want to eat. You know, we want to drive cars. We want hot and cold running water at all times. And things like that are non-negotiable. So do whatever you have to or you won't get reelected. So I think that these people are rational on some level. It's the system as a whole that's irrational. The system as a whole is a machine that's rigged to destroy itself and that doesn't have an off switch. And if you tried to reverse engineer an off switch onto it, it would still blow up and kill a lot of people. So Damn. The politicians aren't really in charge of anything that they can salvage or reuse, you know. They're just like running out their careers the best that they know. And if you ask them on all different levels, every single, you know, politicians, businessmen, engineers, everyone, well, what about the lack of plan? Okay, what about the fact that this doesn't work out in the long run? You know what they'll say to you? Every single one of them. Well, I'll be retired by then. That's the only thing going through their minds.
Which so reminds me of the parable of that I told in the documentary Collapse, the parable of the scorpion and the turtle. Scorpions are only capable of stinging. And they do what they do because that's what they do. And at this point, and you said this almost as much in one of the paragraphs that I quoted from your great essay. Everybody go to cluborloff.blogspot.com. Read this man's amazing writings. But I was having this dialogue today, and you know, I stand firmly with people like Derek Jensen. It's totally time to fight back, because what we are facing now is the shedding of all blood, of all life on the planet, as opposed to perhaps the shedding of some blood which can prevent that. That's why it's become that simple for me, and I will leave that, you know, aside. I'm a warrior and I'm a scout. But fighting can be, as some brave people have done, laying down across the railroad tracks and having a train sever your legs. That's shedding blood, not necessarily someone else's. Okay, now here's time for my song. You ready for my song, Dimitri?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I want to read some of the lyrics of this, because the lyrics are extremely important. I don't know why nobody told you how to unfold your love. I don't know how someone controlled you. They bought and sold you. I look at the world and I notice it's turning. With every mistake, we must surely be learning. I don't know how you were diverted. You were perverted too. I don't know how you were inverted. No one alerted you. I look at you and see all the love that's sleeping while my guitar gently weeps. The song is by George Harrison, and this particular cut was recorded at the Rock and Roll Music Hall of Fame induction ceremony in 2004, just 9 years ago, with a few people I know. Steve Ferroni was playing drums from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Tom Petty was the band leader Stevie Winwood was in the band. Donnie Harrison, George's son, was there performing beautiful. Jeff Lynne from ELO and the Traveling Wilburys was part of this amazing group. But playing guitar on the back end of this song, you'll hear guitar from Steve Winwood and Jeff Lynne, amazing. Tom Petty will sing, and so will Jeff Lynne. But on the back end of this is probably one of the three best guitar players that's ever lived in my lifetime. It's Prince, who just kicks butt. And there are some great videos of this song tribute to George Harrison, including one with Eric Clapton, Paul McCartney, and Ringo Starr. But in my opinion, this is just the most amazing performance. It's on YouTube. While My Guitar Gently Weeps, 2004 Rock and Roll Awards, Tom Petty and Prince just kicking ass. And do yourself a favor, turn it up, turn it up, turn that mofo up, and listen to this song. Here we go.
Gently weeps.
My Guitar Gently Weeps, an amazing band, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Ceremonies, 2004, Prince kicking ass. Okay, we're back with Dmitri Orlov. So, Dmitri, my good friend, we have we walked this path. You've done what you could, and I totally appreciate your candor and your integrity when you say that I've explored this subject. There's only thing left to do now but really experience it for all of us. But, and, you know, I gave up a lot of that stuff a long time ago. I have this show that keeps me in touch with the people who follow me that allows me to continue in my role as scout and commentary and exhortation. But now that it's here, we have X number of time, X amount of time, days, weeks, months, before it's inevitable. And I will say that I'm absolutely convinced that all of us, all 7 billion of us, are going to die probably in very short order. But the question is, how do we spend that time between now and then? There's no point in trying to tell anybody about something that doesn't seem fixable. I agree with Guy McPherson and Carolyn Baker that we are in hospice now. But the question of how we spend that time remains. So, first of all, how are you spending your time? And is there perhaps not, by some magical shift in consciousness, something else that might appear for us to do?
Well, yeah, there's a very, really basic, wonderful shift in consciousness to be performed by all of us, which is stop thinking about the future, live in the now. I have an article coming out this Tuesday. It's part of my Communities That Abide series, and it's about Finland. It's a guest post from my friend Eric Lissens from Finland, and it occurred to us that, well, you look at the United States and it's down, way down in the rankings of countries in terms of how good a place it is for its people. And Finland is near the top. And this is a country that was occupied throughout most of its history. You know, it doesn't have any natural resources, really, except maybe a little timber, but it doesn't grow very fast there because it's close to the Arctic Circle. And yet it is one of the most successful countries in the world by all standards. And we realized that it's been helped by its language, of all things, to a disproportionate extent. So, for instance, they have gender equality because there isn't a word for he and she. There's one word for it, hen. So you can't figure out whether you're talking about a man or a woman most of the time. And, you know, that helps gender equality. No old boy network to, you know, soil thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's helped them a lot. And the other thing that's helped is that their language has no way of talking about the future. So there's no difference between state of being and intention. You are what you plan to do. There's no distinction to be drawn between them. So that's how we need to live. And that's how I live.
Well,
I live
beautiful.
Each day as if it was the last, and as if there was were an infinite number of days exactly like it following.
That was so eloquent, and so, I mean, I'm kind of speechless after that. You still have your boat? Are you living on the boat? Are you planning on going anywhere?
Yeah, I have a boat. It's I had to sell the boat that I really liked, and I bought a bigger boat that I don't really like, and I'm in the process of slowly making it so that I do like it a little more, which, you know, takes a long time. So I'm becoming a diesel mechanic, which I never planned to do. But, you know, things happen.
Yes. We have walked, like I say, this long path, and you know all of the same old, the ancestral voices, if you will, the elder voices of the peak oil movement, from Colin Campbell to the late Matt Simmons to Rich Heinberg. What successes, if any, did we achieve through the course of our long struggle to discuss peak oil, peak resources, and the fact that human civilization was going to collapse if it wasn't addressed? Did we do any good?
Yeah, I think we carved out a niche for people who want to make unpleasant truths known so that the strategy for dealing with them is becoming increasingly complicated and expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of organizations just simply can't afford to put up the wall of bullshit that's needed, and they fold. And I think that's going to become more and more of a trend. I think that, you know, if we prize the truth, I think that we made the truth a little bit more powerful as a way of breaking through.
But boy, we gave it all we had, right? I mean, I know I did.
Yeah, no, I gave it. I devoted a few years of my life to it, and I don't think it's a complete waste. It's touch and go, though. It's like you have to be very careful because people out there will just slander you because that's the cheapest thing to do. So you have to maintain a lot of integrity in order to just open your mouth.
That's the walk, yeah, it sure is, and we have all paid prices for that to one degree or another. You know, I'm stuck by this last couple sentences that I quoted from your, but you wrote, but there may be others. And I'm questioning about the others and us, whether there's a separation and division, who still have some fight left in them and who do not wish to leave a survivable planet and who do wish, excuse me, to leave a survivable planet to their children and grandchildren. Let's not expect them to use conventional orthodox methods to work and play well with others or to be polite and reasonable in dealing with the rest of us. Let's just hope they have a plan and that they get on with it. Well, whoever these they are, let's assume that come the 5th of November and Guy Fawkes Day or something, that there is a massive global uprising. Are you in? Are you part of that? Are you willing? Would you be standing up? Would it be no longer a they, and would it be an us? Because my great hope, you know, and of course the thing that I've always seen as the only hope that we have is if all 7 billion of us realize that we share the common fate. If there is an uprising, where would you be with that? And who are these they? And what does it take to make you one of them?
Well, I don't know who they are. I hope they're younger than I am, much younger. And the advice that I would give them is if you're laying there in a foxhole or, you know, a trench with machine gun fire trained on your head, don't stand up and salute. Don't go up and protest. That would be the wrong thing to do.
Yes.
We have plenty of surplus population that will get destroyed in the process.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be a little smarter than that. That's what I'm talking about, having a plan. Now, you can't really sanction or condone illegal behavior, which is why I'm leaving it very vague. And I really hope that these people are smarter than I am, because I can't really figure out anything to do, and I hope that they can.
And my fundamental question is it illegal behavior to practice self-defense when your life is being directly and imminently threatened? I don't believe that's the case, you know.
Well, there's a thing that you can sort of plead in court called political necessity, and it doesn't work, which is sort of what you're talking about.
Well, we are almost to the point where the courts are extraneous and superfluous, as are all of the trappings that we hope will disappear with collapse so that we may resort to common sense, because I do know that if my life is in imminent danger, and this has been discussed not a lot, not just around Colorado, but in many parts of the country, and I've been privy to some discussions, that in places where there are pristine water tables, if people show up to frack, we will fight and we will use deadly force because we consider that a direct threat to our lives. And we saw something like that with the Osipetagan Mi'kmaq warriors in New Brunswick, which was successful. Deadly force was not used, but they have admitted to torching the police cars, and I think that was totally justified, and hoorah!
There are successes. There are limits set to fracking. There are all sorts of other things, you know, happening not in this country but in other countries. Monsanto has suffered a major setback in Mexico.
1 minute left.
There are a lot of things. There are a lot of things that are positive, that are steps in the right direction. But in terms of a major, you know, uprising, upheaval, etc., I don't think that that's going to solve much of anything. Not that it's not going to happen, but I don't think it's the solution.
well, something has got to happen, or if it doesn't, we're all dead, and I'm going to figure out how to spend my time. Dmitry Orlov, thank you so much for coming back on the Lifeboat Hour with us. This is now your third or fourth appearance here. Thank you for your essay. Thank you for the work you have given us. Thank you for the Russian music. Thank you for your insights. It's been a pleasure to walk a walk with you for some ways, and I hope we get to see each other and talk some more down the road. Thank you so much, Dmitry.
Thank you, Mike.
All right. Everybody's Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, and I think you know where I'll be if the shit goes up. I'll be fighting. And I've been polite for a long time. Anyway, so it is now the 27th of October. We will come back with you in the month of November. I got a surprise visit coming this week from some very cool people from a show called Vice, and maybe they'll let me tell you what's going on with that on the next show. They're arriving tomorrow. I love you guys. We'll see you next week on the Lifeboat Hour. Have a good week. Hang in there. Bye.